I'm going to continue where we left off last time we met. The reason I'm going to do that is because several people said to me that they would like an expansion of what was then said. And I like expanding that particular thing backwards in a sort of contractive manner to concentrate what was there rather than diffused. So I'm going to start with this question of centres in the human being related to certain organic structures in the body, but I'm not going to deal with it anatomically in the occidental sense, but logically in terms of evolution in the individual and human collective and in the cosmic. One of the main difficulties with philosophy is the failure to define terms adequately in each generation. Each philosopher seems to like to start from scratch, which is, as you know, a name of the devil, and is determined, if possible, to ignore the contributions of all other men of the past, except in so far as he believes he can refute them. So we don't actually have a history of philosophy in which the valid contribution of a philosopher is clarified and added to the next philosopher. What we tend to have is one philosopher denying the conclusions of his predecessors in order to establish a new truth. Well, we want to cut across all this by considering from certain dialectical principles what is possible for human thought in considering universal manifestation and the individual within that. To do this, we can start off with our old friend S, where S is the subject, the observer, sentience itself. Sentience means feeling, which is the basis of all knowledge. A plant feels dimly, an animal feels a little more acutely, a human being has a magnifying glass on his sufferings so that he can actually make them bigger than they are by a process of feedback. But in all cases, sentience is at the basis of what is happening. So when we write S, we shall mean the perceiving subject of phenomena. We shall mean the consciousness internal to which all objects appear. We shall mean an infinite field of sentience. We shall mean that it's infinite because we cannot actually define the limits of anything other than an object. To define, by the meaning of the term and the fin in define, which means end, to define is to indicate the limits of extension of any given being. So we can only define that which has limits. Anything whatever that can be defined with limits, that we can refer to as an object or as phenomena, or we can say of it that it is a content of sentience itself. When sentience analyzes itself and verbalizes its analytical process, sentience is then called consciousness. When sentience is on guard against a very wide field of possibilities, we call it awareness. These are words from different languages simply because different peoples have developed sentience in different ways. Remember that the SCI in conscious comes from a root meaning to cut, to shear, as you see in scissors. So consciousness itself means an analytical process. You cut total reality into bits in order to become conscious. If you don't cut it into bits and analyze it, although you are sentient, that is, you can feel, although you may be aware of a widely diffused threat to your existence, you are not conscious until you analyze and verbalize the content of your sentience. sentience therefore includes all modes of knowing within itself, and it is the infinite field internal to which some of its processes are analytic, and those analytic processes are the means whereby we become clearer and clearer about what is happening. When we define any situation whatever, we become by that act of definition more in charge of a situation than we would otherwise do. I went to a football match once, 1926. And the man who took me because I didn't want to go. And he thought that it was very wrong of me to say that it was a waste of my time to go to a football match, and therefore I ought to go for my education's sake. So I went, because I love education. And when I got there, I couldn't tell Spud from Murphy. Those of you who are not old enough to understand that, mean that that was the hero of the day. But I couldn't be bothered with the geometry of the football field. I didn't define the shirts were rather similar of the two teams. And the result was, I didn't know who won or lost, and I didn't want to know. All I knew was that the weather was very cold, it was foggy, and there was a fellow walking about, obviously very sick, nigh unto death, trying to persuade other people to buy what he said were cough cure tablets. And he was coughing throughout this fog. Now, because I couldn't understand the rules, and didn't want to understand those rules, although I'm very interested in geometry, and I didn't like to waste my time deciding why a sudden roar went up, it can be said that I was not conscious of what was going on. I was aware that there was movement. But peripherally, I was aware that men were rushing about, and that some people shouted, for some reason or other, every now and then, very loud, and began to thump each other. But I had sentience, but I had no consciousness of what was going on. And being a stickler for precise significances, I did not pretend to be conscious. So when this man said, "Well, did you understand it?" And I said, I was totally unconscious of what was going on, and he accused me of abstractive processes, introversion, lack of communication, and a variety of other things. I haven't been since, and I have not bothered to commit to memory the geometry of the football field. But I know from occasional accidental viewing on the TV that there is sometimes sufficient difference of shirts to say why one man is treating another. The important thing is that when we define and analyze, only when we do so are we conscious. And where we do not define, we cannot act as referee. It would be no good at all giving the whistle to me on a football field and saying, "Referee this." Because I wouldn't know when to blow the whistle, except if I happen to feel from the rhythmical pattern of movement that a whistle here or there would help. So we have to be very careful. We are thoroughly conscious, that is, we verbally define what we mean with every term we use, and we are talking about sentience. We're saying sentience comes from a word meaning to feel. That feeling is the means whereby basically every living form is aware of itself and its environment. But within the field of sentience, we can define objects without in any sense defining sentience. No philosopher has ever defined sentience, awareness, consciousness adequately so that any other being with no awareness, no consciousness and no sentience has been able to understand it. It is only possible to talk about sentience to sentient beings, to talk at all to anybody requires them to have a sufficient vocabulary to be conscious, that is to be analytic, at least about the sounds you're using to represent certain ideas. So when we try to examine sentience, we must recognize that nothing whatever can be said about sentience other than this. It is that in which phenomena occur, in which objects are presented. And we say we are beings of five senses. We smell, not stink, as Dr. Johnson said. We smell, taste, touch, hear. There's one missing. Seeing is the tyrant, because seeing gives you the defined edge whereby you are led to separate from sentience its content. With the play of light on the retina, you are led by differences of tone value and colour to assume contours where you see changes which are then assumed to belong to what we call an object. An object is something most clearly defined by the eye. So that the eye has become, in ancient literatures, and certainly in all initiatory rites of the great religions, the supreme tyrant and supreme agent of the intellect. By means of adequate vision and definition of forms as perceived by the eye, it is possible to learn to think geometrically. And when we do this, we can discover that although we can never consider sentience as such, we can actually consider the objects within sentience, and then it does not matter whether sentience has any significance at all, because instead of looking for significance in sentience where it has no existence, we look for significance in the object. Now I'm going to say that within sentience there are certain perceptive possibilities. I'm going to write a P there for perception, for phenomena, for predication. Now the field of sentience must be undefined, or if we like, we can define it negatively by saying it is infinite. Infinite means not finite, and it doesn't mean anything else. The field of sentience is not finite and is therefore non-defined. But the field of sentience is that internal to which all the objects we know about present themselves. Philosophically, it's very often useful to call them phenomena. Phenomena means names separated from other names. A noumenon is a name standing in its own right as a mode of absolute definition. The prefix before it, using a letter phi, which means analysis, means that we can take the noumenon and turn it into a phenomenon by deliberately segregating it from the totality of other phenomena within the field of sentience. So we can say that any sentient being can be represented by S, and the content of any sentient being can be represented by P. That which is precipitated, that which is phenomenal or analyzable, that which is posited within sentience is represented by P. So that in a simple twofold analysis of ultimate reality, we do not actually need more symbols than S and P. It's rather like binary. You know, if you want to write a number in binary, as opposed to a deanery system, you're only allowed to use 1 and 0. So if I said 1 and 0 like that, in binary, that does not mean 10. Because I'm only allowed to use these two numbers, so I can't fill the space in between here with the others from 2 to 9. And so it's very, very useful to be able to write yes, no, something, nothing, and deal with everything in the universe in that way, amidst computers possibly. In the same way, in philosophy, we could use S and P. We could say we're either referring to sentience or to what is posited within sentience. If we refer to sentience, we have nothing to say other than this, that it is that in which P is posited. But nevertheless, we could analyze every conceivable phenomenal structure, object or event in P terms. All we would have to say is P is the pattern which appears within sentience, and we could then compare patterns and ignore the sentience and be concerned with the pattern, because it is only the pattern that determines what we mean by efficiency. A man who designs a motor car engine or a jet plane engine or an engine for an ocean liner is concerned with different patterns. He's concerned with the way we arrange P. A primary particle, pluralized, like a lot of little ball bearings, and then arranged in patterns, constitutes the analyzable universe. Sentience is beyond analysis, forever, because it is that internal to which the analytical process must take place. What takes place, what is posited within sentience, that we can deal with. So in the very simple analysis we can say ultimate reality is polarized as sentience and power, and we must now ignore the sentience and concentrate on the power of positing the phenomena particularized within it. When we do this, we'll say, well, it's going to be very complicated. You see, to program a computer, you have to train somebody in this binary system, and you have to get that person to reduce everything that he knows to a yes-no. In philosophy, we'd have to say, reduce everything you know to P. That's the play of patterns, posited, phenomenally, within sentience. Well, you could do it, but, like the binary, you would have to train for it. And that was one of the main objects of the Buddhist religion, which set out to say only sentience is non-conditioned. All phenomena are conditioned. Now, do you wish to be conditioned or non-conditioned? Nobody knew what he was talking about, so they all said, please, we like to be non-conditioned. Because you put an emotive tone in the one and not in the other. Would you prefer to be free or in jail? Everybody shouts free. They don't bother to analyse the jail. Actually, it's an old name of God tying himself up. And that there is no jail whatever, other than that posited by sentience within itself. Jail is form. Jail is any form whatever anywhere. Prison is form. B for prison. There are no prisons other than forms posited within sentience. Buddha said only sentience is unconditioned. You conditioned lot. And they said, oh, we're terribly sorry. How do we get to that? He said, well, give it all up. Stop positing. Stop thirsting. Stop being hungry and just be sentient. Now, anybody who listened to him immediately got out of the way of all the businessmen, as you can imagine, who were very busy positing. And if everybody had taken Buddha seriously and gone on with their sentience and abandoned their positing, there'd have been a lot more space in India for further positors to push around in. But most of them didn't understand what he was talking about. And as soon as he was dead, and even before, they were busy positing again. And they hadn't stopped yet until they asked for pill. Now, we can see that handling philosophy in this polarized way does not make it terribly easy unless we train ourselves all the time. You meet Mr. Smith, Trevor. And instead of saying that's Mr. Smith, you say, oh, that's P to the 2, 3, 5, 4 to the 10. It's very confusing. It's more convenient to say, there is Trevor, a verse. And this way, it's economic to deal with each other, rather than a simple binary philosophy. So it sometimes helps to add another term. If we see that sentience is that internal to which phenomena appear, that internal to which is posited the particular particle, the patterning of which constitutes the world, we can say, let it be imagined that between these two something is happening. A process is occurring of circumscription. Now, we can write an O in here to symbolize circumscription. I will now change this diagram, because that is the original sock that the solid globe would be made into, if we were to pursue the philosophy thoroughly. And we're going to say, we're now going to write the circle there and put the P inside it and the S outside it. And this circle is to remind us that what we mean by phenomena, what we mean by particularized particular patterning, is circumscription. The fact that SOP is the ancient word for wisdom, Sophia, derives from this observation. Everything that can be circumscribed is now within P, or P is to circumscribe. P and O are contingent on each other, and they are congruent absolutely. S is the observing subject, internal to which, it's all S around here, internal to which phenomena are positive. So we now have a threefold system. Now, when we have the system, we observe, factually, that we become more efficient in handling phenomena, which is the only thing to be handled anyway, the more accurately we can circumscribe a situation. If you go to Her Majesty's stationery offices, you can find a little guidebook called Careers. In that book, you will find you can be a teacher, or a dentist, or an atomic scientist, and all sorts of funny things. This is a basic book that tells you what P you are if you read the book and are influenced by it. Once you are posited on the book and the book acts on you, you are possibly conditionable by the terminology of the book. It has a very high sale, that book, actually. So we see here that in order to decide what to do, you must circumscribe the infinity of possibilities and select from infinite possibility that you think you are most likely to be profitably employed in. Now we find here, change the diagram again, we're going to put sentence at the top, we're going to put P at the bottom. That's P for perhaps. Between these two, we're going to put the zone O, and we're going to remember that this P really belongs in that O. But we're going to say a funny thing about it. That if we cover this whole thing like this, we've drawn a diagram of a being separated out in a linear manner, rather like a human being. A human being has five senses in the head, and he has a positor down below, and he has a zone between into which S is infiltrating and P is infiltrating. Now, we have a threefold division here, and we can say there is sense information coming in through the five senses in the head. There is a positing energy at the other end of the body, tending to posit regardless. And there's a zone of interrelation where the senses fabricate from their own activities what they are pleased to define as rules, which they then try to impose on the positing tendencies. And the positing tendencies, being serpentine, are very subtle, and they try to avoid whatever impositions there are, whatever inhibitions there are, upon their activities. So there arises between them a zone of interference of S and P, a zone that is tremendously important, because that zone, psychologically, is the zone of the affect. That is, the zone of emotional play, the zone where you suffer emotionally from the necessity of choice. Now, if we send the force down to something that we have positive, that force will bounce back again to the source. So that the energy thrown onto a centre from the periphery bounces back to the periphery. Once a periphery has come to be, when we do the S outside of the circumscribed zone, once the periphery has come to be, energy pressing upon it can in fact be bounced from the periphery back to the initiating source. So there arises another zone, a zone between S and O, and another zone between O and P. If we say that this middle zone here is the zone in which emotive responses occur to the impositions of controls upon basic impulses, then we can say that in the battle of the zone, the S, which is free, is more able to work upon the emotive zone from above and to see it objectively. But the P, which is below, produces a zone of interaction here, so that when it sees the desire or the emotive charge to be already tainted by orders from above, a conflict will appear in which the P tries to avoid the tainting of the pure impulse by the intellectively imposed taboo. We've now got a fivefold system. Now let's apply this, as we did before, to a human being, and we'll say the human being has these three parts, and we'll observe the nexus here between them. The head is lifted away from the rest of the body in order that the head may be able to consider consciously, that is analytically, whatever messages come to it from below. The essential thing about that head is that it must be able to shelter itself sufficiently to be able to consider what would be the best formal response to any phenomenal stimulus. So at the top end there we have the function of reason, at the other end the function of pure impulse, the unconsidered impulse, which always feels exactly right unless it is actually punished, which means negated in its power, by some action of a restraining force. Between the reason and the spontaneous impulse arises the zone of conflict. Shall I? Shall I not? Let's say yes or Y down there and no up there. A no in the head and a yes in the lower tummy. And then let's say that the head comes down and writes no, and the tummy rises up and writes yes. So it's in the chest region there is a conflict between yes and no. Yes comes from below, I affirm life. No comes from above. You know what happens when you affirm life? You get into trouble. The one below rising up says, nevertheless I affirm, because if I accept your no, I die. And the one above says, either you accept my no or we all die. And therefore, in this chest zone, there is this tremendous zone of conflict. Hanoi, of course, has just a couple of these with the N and the Y in a different order. The whole object is to annoy the whole being so that the whole being becomes aware to what he shall say yes and to what no. Now, as we've seen in the other diagram, when the no-sayer, or law, the control, says no, and the one below says yes, and produces a conflict zone, the existing conflict zone now produces, between it here, an analytical device. Because now the law, the no-sayer, the nous, he who knows, examines the conflict and by verbal trickery proceeds to sort out the nature of the conflict. Whereas down below there is a zone here coming into being where the positive spontaneous impulse of life says to itself, I suspect that this no stuff is going on up there. I will have to defend myself with all certainty. If we allowed that the free, spontaneous, natural impulse is the good, then we would have to abandon all control and civilization would probably disappear. If we say that we will curb this yes, but by pure imposition from above, without waiting for understanding, we will produce a profoundly negative state with ultimate impotence and the disappearance of the human race through impotence. What is required is that there shall be a balancing of these processes. This five-fold division has arisen because we have sentience and positing within it. These interact and produce a zone of conflict, and then with the sentience imposing knows here, there has arisen a mediating zone, which is your larynx, and between this chest zone and this impulse zone there has arisen the solar plexus there, which tells you that you'll have to become very, very subtle to defeat the verbalizing impositions of the law. Now, all of these processes are essential for human evolution. There is no possibility of saying one of these is good and the rest is bad. It has been historically convenient for the ones in the head zone who say no to say to the spontaneous responders, you are wrong, because in the days of the spontaneous response, civilization is impossible. Let's therefore take this and see how we divide it. We used a six-fold division last time, and we can do exactly the same thing now by simply positing inside here subdivision. Now, if we take it like this, and we now start at the bottom, and we'll say the sexual center down there, and that circle is centered on the navel. So you have a sexual impulse, a navel which guarantees you had parents and therefore makes you a family man, a herd animal, a solar plexus brain there which is instinctive and perfectly matched to the environment, so that the solar intelligence in the solar plexus is invariably right within the environment that gave birth to its knowledge. But it is not invariably right in another environment. If we take a polar bear with its instincts in the Arctic Circle and put it in an equatorial jungle, it will become confused. Its instincts will not have the appropriate stimuli. So, remember that your solar plexus is infallible in its conclusions, providing you are in the environment in which that solar plexus got its information. Now, from the solar plexus here to the heart, we have a slightly different process going on. This heart centre came into existence as a result of the interplay of sentience and phenomena, or the law of consciousness analysis and the spontaneous impulse. The heart itself is the centre of the whole being and is the supreme evaluating centre of sentience. But between the chest and the head comes the larynx, and that is your verbalizing centre. And in the head, between the eyebrows, you have a centre called the command centre, individual. And at the top of the head there, where babies have a little hole, you have a universal. When we look at this analysis, we see what we did before. The universal there contains the potentialities of all that are at the other end of the being. Whatever occurs in the sexual drive, the attempt to posit children, that is, new phenomena, new forms of being, is a potentiality in the universal there. So these two are in opposition, not as enemies, but opposition spatially, because one of them is a universal cosmic, the other one is a particularizing individuated procreator. The space between your eyebrows, just slightly above them, your individual command center, is opposed to your herd instinct. The thing that makes you a member of a family, whether it's a little family, the one that generated you, or the nation, or the total terrestrial community, this is in opposition with your individual being. But they are not enemies, but they frequently function as if they were. But when they do so in order to be friends, because only good fences make good neighbours. And if you wish to stay on good terms with members of your own family, the best thing to do is to remove to the antipodes. There's a certain natural law about that, and misinformation about that holds people together in continuous enmity. They would be far happier friends far apart. It's to do with the dispersal of characteristics through the infinite continuum. Now, in the same way that this opposition exists, so there is opposition between verbalization, which is serial, moment by moment you say a word, a word, a word, and the solar plexus, which is simultaneous knowledge from a given environment. Your verbal center analyzes what your solar plexus simultaneously comprehends. And the heart is the pivotal center for all these processes. We have three down here, three above, and one in the middle. Further subdivision of the chest would show that we have certain processes going on the diaphragm, and certainly in the upper chest, where there's a funny little gland that has certain relations there. And of course, when we did that, we get a ninefold division, and we can go on doing all kinds of funny things by subdividing our initial concept. What we have to remember is that our subdivisions are for our increased efficiency and not for anything else, and that there is no entity status of self-existence within anything we define other than that we choose arbitrarily to use as an entity. The only reality is whole reality, and anything abstracted from it by the intellect for its own purposes, wrenched out of its holistic content, is thereby rendered that much less relational, that much less powerful, that much less efficient. Now, we can see here the meaning of power differentiation, because if we look at this diagram, we can see that it represents a process of evolution and involution, if we start with the cosmos up here and pass it progressively downwards, we will find that cosmic energies first posit individuated centres of sentience. Those individuated centres of sentience verbalise, let us say they vibrate sonically. They, observing their own vibratory state, feel the verbalizations through the feeling are gathered together into a unity and generate this solar intelligence of the animal. This solar intelligence posits a family as a means of development, because only groups provide each other with sufficient stimulus to develop the individuals within the group. This group posits the individual. That is the process of involution. That the cosmic posits its primordial monads, the unities of sentience, that they vibrate and verbalize their own content, that feeling their own verbalizations, they unify them and make a solar intelligence, which is instinctive. That makes the group or family, and that posits the individual. Now, the process of evolution this way is that every individual has to belong, in order to evolve, to a family, has to be subjected to the collective instinctive knowledge of the group to which he belongs, and then he has to climb up to evaluate in feeling the evolution of the instinct of compassion rising out of the solar plexus. And when he has felt this unity of all beings instead of simply of his own group, then to verbalize his relation with forces of the source, of the origin, and then in the process of verbalization to integrate himself as an individual. When he is a self-conscious, evolved individual able to articulate his inner content, then he is in a state where he can assert his cosmic origin and his cosmic intent to cooperate with all other beings who are cosmically determinant. So involution is a process from the cosmic downwards to the particular individual, evolution upwards from the individual to the cosmic. Now, in terms of efficiency, the more you know formally about a situation, the better equipped you are to deal with it. The freer you are from emotional contagion, the better you are to deal with it. And the more free energy you have, the better you are able to deal with it. If we take this word, the only Egyptian word for a priest, we see here the same kind of division, in which power and sentience here is breeding a relation between it. H has always been the glyph of power. It means control, it means hedging, it means ditching, it means ladders of high design. Power in the universe differentiates, that's the R. The differentiation of those powers result in expressions. Every time you differentiate a power, there is a stimulus from the differentiation, and the whole thing feeds back. The vowels here mean God, the vowel here means the world. So within this word, we have a series of glyphs which imply that there is more efficiency in the differentiated mind, in free power, and freedom from emotional contagion. This is obviously a very, very high aim for a person involved in an emotive situation. A person involved in an emotive situation does not want to know what are the formal facts. A man may fall in love with a woman with bow legs. We can find a tribe that think they're beautiful and send him there, and then everybody will be happy. It is true that we can find forms that will please anybody in the universe And it is equally true that we usually find people not in the places where those forms are. Because if they were exactly where they would be satisfied, the universe would be static. And therefore there has been a big mixing process. Creation and the word creator are fundamentally the same word, and the creator is a mixing bowl. The fundamental idea of creation is to get everybody who is thoroughly satisfied as far away from the being that can satisfy them as possible, and then say, right, find it. And viewed from a helicopter, it makes very interesting patternings, which people of geomantic extraction like doing in slow motion on TV. The important thing about it is that to deny that differentiation of power is a way to efficiency is simply to regress to an earlier level. Remember, when we take a monocell, some living protoplasm with no divisions within it, if we give a stimulus that is an energy input into that protoplasm, the energy goes inside it, bangs against the walls, reverberates in there, and there is no discrimination within that being. It is simply moved by the energy input and the energy which constitutes its own being. If we put two stimuli into that being, mark one B and the other A, the one called A will cover the whole sphere with A, the one called B will cover it with B, and there will be no possibility in that being of discrimination. If we were to fire all the letters of the alphabet simultaneously at an amoeba, it would vibrate alphabetically, simultaneously, comprehensively, but it would not comprehend Shakespeare's serial order of presentation. This method of mashing up the whole thing is called protopathic response, and it depends on a monocell having no internal subdivisions. This kind of being goes about and it evacuates anywhere, from any point whatever. It ingests food by throwing out prolongations, pseudopodia, and then it retracts them, and it piles up rubbish in itself and it goes anywhere. There's no possibility of saying, would you mind that away, you see. Whereas a little thing called paramecium has more consideration. It has actually drilled a little hole in itself, and it's always in the same place. So if you approach a paramecium from the front, you don't get insulted. Whereas with this protopathic geezer, you can actually be insulted very easily. If you had friends who suddenly opened a very large paw and blew out of it what they didn't want, and you never knew where the paw was going to open, you would say, well, I must defend myself somehow, as I've got to accelerate my own paw openings in all directions, or retire from this place. The process of evolution is retiring from this place, namely the pond. Climb out and start being a unidirectional being with a front end and a back end, with a notice on both. Remember, all your features are notices for other beings to interpret. Now, protopathic response is no good, and it is the biggest single enemy of the next step in human evolution. Human evolution is a movement of cosmic intelligence to produce within itself pluralizations. The S produces the P's. Each one of these positive beings has a destiny to fulfill, and the end of its destiny is that each positive being within the field of sentience shall be able to function consciously and deliberately and by act of will, freely, from within itself. It shall be absolutely self-determinant and absolutely reflective, and when this has occurred, so that all the energy inside cosmos is actually energy of absolute self-determination, then that is the end of evolution. The human race is not there yet altogether. There have been indicators in the past of the possibilities. We have seen in Europe certain kinds of psychological movements, generally subsumed under mysticism. We've seen the same in India and yoga and so on. All these processes are simply attempts on the part of an evolving cosmic being precipitating itself into individuation states to get hold of itself and make a plurality of conscious creative beings. The only way to this is by heightened awareness of the processes whereby one becomes what one is. Now, if we take the being below, the belly being, which reproduces and belongs to a family and has an instinctive intelligence, and examine that being, we find that such a being cannot get away from its herd. All its instinctive intelligence binds it within the herd and simply posits within the herd another form like itself, so that that being cannot evolve to become a reflexive being, self-determinant, consciously creating, like the original cosmic creator. So we have to say, we have to lift this being up somehow out of the herd. You notice that Christ said that he had come to destroy certain facts in the world, and notably amongst these facts was the fact of family. When he was required to go back to his mama and his brothers and so on, he said, "Who is my mother and father and sisters and brothers? Those who do the will of my father." He denied terrestrial relationships of the physical order to be valid. He was anti-family, anti-biological group, and pro-logos, pro-cosmic thinking. Buddha did the same thing because he did a very naughty, unethical thing. He deserted his wife and child in the middle of the night and went away without telling her. That's very unethical, and yet he became a saviour for millions. Other saviours in the past have had to break the herd instinct and the tie that stops individuated self-determination. Every point must become self-determinant, because logically that which is not self-determinant is going to be determined by something outside itself. The man who will not study what is happening in Vietnam or Biafra, and who yet presumes to vote upon it, is a fool. If he is going to speak about it, he should know about it. But unless he individuates himself and integrates himself, then that man is not qualified to speak, and he knows it. And because he knows it, he joins the herd. So that as soon as you say, "But you have no knowledge," he invokes all his friends to come and beat you. Because he knows that if he doesn't beat you, he will have to change. And he is at the level of belonging to the herd and living instinctively. But evolution is going to wipe out every being that is not self-determining. Because the aim of evolution is the creation of self-determinant, self-conscious, reflexive beings. We've had a couple of wars, we're going to have another one. In this third one, there will be such a stimulus presented to people that they will have to decide whether or not they're going to passively allow governments to slaughter them for purposes they know nothing about. Every person after the Third World War will have to take a hand in his own government. He cannot put a mark on a piece of paper and say, "Now I don't have to think anymore." Men are sitting in a big house doing something so mysterious for my welfare that they won't let me take a TV camera in to watch them. The Third World War will give us a bang to the human race for every individual to decide that he must know what he's doing. And when all the beings in the world know what they're doing, so that no one of them can be duped by the others, then the evolutionary process is completed, and the process called New Heaven, New Earth appears in its fullness. Now, let's consider another aspect. We're getting near the end. Let's consider certain terms in relation to a fivefold division and see what the work is one has to do in order to integrate. We will say we have a physical body, we'll call it a physbod, because that's what it does, and this physbod is made of minerals from the earth. Every physical body of every living being we know is made of minerals from the earth by a certain agency. If you take a man and put him in the crematorium and go through the procedure, you can get a little pile of somebody else's ashes back. But you will certainly get a mineral content, not an organic being after it's been through the fiery furnace. Jews don't like it because of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, it is a fact that the minerals of the earth that lie inertly on the ground are picked up by plants, trees, and so on, and that to do this, they need light from the sun and a substance called chlorophyll. And with the aid of this substance and the light, they are able to take out of the atmosphere some carbon. They are able to mix with water, minerals from the earth, and they are able to take the so-called inanimate, inorganic mineral world and organize it in the form of a plant. And therefore, we have to say there is a process above the level of the mineral. Anybody can go around and kick a rock when he's in a bad temper. And the rock has no redress other than Newton's law of action reaction, and it can't even determine that. Above the level of that physical body, which is chemical, there is a force which vitalizes and organizes. Now, this is a fact. This is the one we call the biofield. Because there is a field of force which organizes the mineral world and patterns it in ways quite beyond the power of minerality itself. The mineral world cannot grow by ingesting other minerals, changing their forms, and moving about. It lies statically, and in the case of so-called crystal growth, it is by accretion from outside. But this vital organizing force, which is intimately connected with solar radiation, is able to pick up these minerals from the earth and in the air and to make an organized vital body. So that we have to say that the collectivity of vital organizing forces, which takes these minerals to the world, must be considered to be, in its own sense, at its own level, a kind of being. Now, if we use the word body, we don't have to mean by the word body gross, heavy, coarse material, mineral. By body, we can mean anything whatever that we circumscribe, because the letter B originally was a circle, and meant to circumscribe, and analyze, we put a D in it to symbolize that we divide it. A body is any energy system, whatever, that is circumscribed. So we can talk about a body of opinion. We could talk about a body of radio energies issuing from a certain radio station. We can talk about bodies of influence, bodies of emotion, bodies of spirit, and so on. Body does not necessarily mean gross material of the heavy mineral sort. Body is any zone that we can circumscribe and thereby divide from any other zone. So we can talk about a vital organizing body. And we can talk about a physical mineral body. And we can say that the collectivity of mineral elements in a body, if the vital organizing body removes, begins to disintegrate. When the vital forces depart from an organized mineral body, the mineral bodies start returning to the place they came from. Now, we have not only a vital organizing complex of energies, but we have also another one which mobilizes us, because we don't only grow fatter and fatter day by day, we also get up and run about and reduce it a bit. So we have to say we have another body up here, and we will call it the mobilizing or activating principle here, and psychologically we experience it as desire, but we'll call it here an active mobilizing function. We run about as well as living. We live when we're asleep and relaxed in bed. A new principle is operative when we run about. When we observe, we're climbing up from a purely passive mineral state in which another being who is vital can come along and grind us to bits and swallow us and convert us to its cause, like a plant does. There's a definite climb, because the plant has got one over the mineral world. It can do something with it that the mineral world cannot do itself. The plant takes a certain amount of mineral elements from the earth and picks them up in the act of growth and defies gravity. The mineral is entirely gravity dominated. The plant is not. Now, just as that plant can defy the horizontal of gravity, so there's another principle here that can defy gravity and the confinement to the vertical movement and move about horizontally. So that we find we have a desire nature and we have an active mobilizing body. And this active mobilizing body can run about and rip trees up by the roots and throw them on fires and break rocks up. In other words, that active mobilizing body has got superiority over the merely organizing vital body or the physical body. Now, above this active running about mind, this process of deciding to rush here and there, to evaluate this is this and this is that, in terms of action, we have another kind of body, which we will call the mental body. And this body is able to calculate where to run to without actually running. And this, the totality of the energies that calculate in the mind, the totality of those energies is the mental body. Now, the person who can evaluate his desires, his organic processes, his physical mineral body, that person can decide, oh, I'm vitamin C deficient today, I think I'll swallow a couple. And he can balance himself up in this way. He is superior to a being who cannot do this but must rush about. As that being is superior to one that simply grows and organizes, as that is superior to one that lies about on the ground. So there is a definite climb in power and efficiency to the level of the mind. Now, the mentation process there represented is empirical, and it merely counts what it has got through having a physical body, a vital organizing complex of energies, an activating mobilizing complex of energies, and all these have acted in such a way there has been an evaluation, empirical, That is, all the data is supplied from below. But above this empirical mind, there is another mind. Above that empirical mind, there is one subtle one, for which the term buddhi is used. We'll put buddhi down there. Buddha is the intellect. This is that process which does not need an external stimulus to determine it. And that particular body there is able, without any external data, without reference to the mineral world, without reference to vital organization, without reference to active mobilization, without reference to empirical data, to determine from within itself the pure logic of possibility. Gautama Buddha represented pure intellection that could sit down under a bow tree or a banyan tree or a banana tree or any other tree you like, and from within himself he could produce an intellectual analysis of a situation that did not yet exist. From that realm of cosmic intellect, sitting down inside himself, he was able to determine and to influence one man, millions of people at the other level. He knew kings who were at the mental level. He knew other fellows at the active level. Some who were lounging about just being organisms, and some that were walked upon like minerals. But he knew something else that he didn't need to run about. He had a dialectical principle inside him of cosmic intellection, and it consisted in the discovery that every process downwards was developed deliberately by a process of internal self-positing. That this original cosmic intellection preceded the mentation of the empirical order, the active mobilization of the animal body, the vital organizing of your vegetative system, and the minerality of your physical body. So that he completed the process to a certain level, the cosmic level. Now there is only one level beyond that, and that level is itself the infinite, the undefinable. Buddha covers everything that is definable, and beyond that there is only the undefinable, which is the absolute source of the whole process. And when there is a certain little formula in yoga of being, consciousness, bliss, this top level is being referred to. You know that bliss means the uninterrupted motion of the will. You know that form interrupts. So this bliss level must be above the limitations. And we see in Atma, spirit, buddhi, manas, the higher trinity. There is free spirit, cosmic intellection, individual mentation. That is the top triad, and those are beyond all the determinations from below. And if we take these four processes here, we can refer to them as lower individual personality. That the man of the empirical mind, who knows because he has studied empirically, is clever in proportion to his studies and his degree of mobility and his vital organizing drive and a physical body to start from. That man is what we call a personality. There's a very, very important rule, and that is, until you integrate your personality, you cannot become spiritually illuminated. Until you can make your physical body obey you and your vital organism obey you and your active mobilizing impulses obey you, so that you only run about if you decide to, until you can integrate those processes, you are not yet ready for the higher triad. Number seven, in the ancient world, a holy number, was so formed because it refers to this fact that we have a physical body with vital impulses, mobilizing tendencies and mentation. These have to be integrated, and when they're integrated, you have a personality, a very clever, shiny fellow. But that personality man is empirical. He's an encyclopedic salesman on the door. He has studied externally. And if he studied very hard, he's very, very clever, empirically. And when he has made that personality in that way, then his next step is to offer to cosmic service all his cleverness. If he decides to keep his cleverness for his own defined finite circle, he can't move up. But if he defines that, having integrated himself so that he's so clever that he could really take advantage of millions if he so wished, because there are sufficient millions of people not clever, if he decides to dupe, he remains on the lower level, a clever personality, a Hitler, a Mussolini, or whatever you like, a Napoleon. But if he decides that he will dedicate himself to absolute service, then the whole of this process is changed in a very mysterious way. The transfiguration in Christianity refers to this, that at the moment a very clever integrated man decides that he will not use his cleverness for furthering his own private individual ends, at that moment the whole of his being has all the divisions that were taken into it for evolutionary purposes washed out. It becomes a unity. You can see that this cannot happen unless that person dedicates to the service of the absolute. Because if he decides to keep for his private ends his cleverness, he is keeping the divisions in himself that brought him into being. But if he keeps those divisions in himself, he is on guard. If he's on guard, he's inhibited. He's walled in. If he's inhibited in this private way, then the spiritual triad above him cannot subserve his purpose, because it is not their purpose. And therefore, although they're present all the way through him, his own fear of the defeat of his private purpose will keep him partitioned and hide from him aspects of his own being, which will keep him at the level that he will always be inefficient in relation to those higher beings. And just as the vital organizing self is cleverer than the physical, and the active mobilizing self is cleverer than the vital and the physical, and the mentation is cleverer than the three of them, so the spiritual triad beings above the private clever fellow utilize his private cleverness to further their cosmic purpose. So we see that the whole process involves a departure from the absolute and a return to the absolute, a precipitation from omniscience into nescience, from knowing all to knowing nothing except the darkness of minerality, and then a gradual climb out until that being is so saturated with this world's cleverness that he comes to the level where he knows as a fact that he could dupe millions of people to subserve his end. Because until he reaches that level, he cannot dedicate himself wholly. It's no good a person who is not integrated, who is not truly a person, a being who is in the life of running about stage, who may rush about and give you a pamphlet about a new religion or something. It's no good him dedicating himself to cosmos, because he has nothing yet to offer. He is a tool to another being. The only being that can be of any real service to the spiritual triad that controls cosmos is the being who has integrated his four levels, so that that being is a true personality with all his parts obeying that center of mentation in him, so that he constitutes a valid unific offering. At that point and at no other, he can say, right, I remove the necessary private binding lines of my evolutionary process, and I now slip into the sea of the infinite, determined that I will not exist anymore as other than an instrument. And then he is the prodigal son that Christ talked about. He has done everything, he has integrated everything, and he has given it up. Whatever he had done had enriched his sentience, and this richness he offers to the absolute. And in the very act of being able to offer it, he rubs out the final separating concept, the concept of private purpose. And rubbing that out, there is no difference whatever between his will and the absolute. In which case, whatever he says is absolute. And all the beings below him will not be able to comprehend what he's doing, because they will comprehend at their own particular level. But he will become that mysterious pearl that the whole field is bought for, referred to in the parable. Remember that pearl is grown out of irritation. The irritation of phenomena within sentience has caused the precipitation of beings who ultimately will become absolutely self-determined. To recognize the efficiency, inefficiency of the levels of being, to recognize that all things have authority on what is below them and subservience to what is above them, except the top and the bottom. The absolute has nothing above it and is self-determinant. The bottom has nothing below it and is totally enslaved. And in between these two, there is a hierarchy of developing, evolving beings.